Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Director James Cameron of Titanic fame and Avatar and more is headed down to the deepest trench in the ocean, nearly 7 miles down into the Pacific's Mariana Trench in what they call Challenger Deep, the deepest ocean point on Earth. It's half a century since anyone's been there. No one's ever gone alone before. What's down there? As Cameron is poised for his dive out in the Pacific, we'll ask. This hour, On Point, the life and landscape of the deepest depths of the sea. Another world. Later this hour, we'll talk to the leader of a new sea expedition to find Amelia Earhart's plane wreckage and maybe the Great Flyer's remains. But first, the deep, deep sea. Let's listen back for just a moment. These were two men who went down in 1960, more than 50 years ago, the last time this realm has been broached. Don Walsh and Jacques Piccard descended to the bottom of the Mariana Trench in the research vessel Trieste. Here's a National Geographic documentary where their engineers and scientists associated with the expedition talk about the day the Trieste made its descent.
There was a lot to think about that morning. The sea state was somewhat rough.
Well, that day was pretty bad. We ended up on the rough sea, and the Trieste was pretty bad. The inside was more safe than the outside.
The moment comes, if you miss it, it may never happen.
You can do all the preliminary work and all the rehearsals, but when you make that final push to the very bottom of the ocean, boy, this is for keeps.
Right now, James Cameron out on the Pacific, a couple hundred miles south of Guam on the Mermaid Sapphire, waiting to go down. Here he was last Friday during preparations for his dive, telling the Pacific News Center about some of the special stabilizing features of his kind of rocket sub. It will go straight down.
It's got two fins. They're actually on the back. And if you imagine, it's kind of like a Swiss Army knife. When it's descending, one fin folds up and the other one acts as a stabilizer when it's going down. When it's coming up, the reverse happens. The top one folds down and the bottom fin stabilizes the sub. Because this sub screams down and screams back to the surface.
And it is a long way down to the bottom here. We're talking almost 7 miles. We want to look at what's down there, what we may find, what we know already. With us today from Oakland, California's famed deep-sea oceanographer, Dr. Sylvia Earle. She's been called her deepness by the New York Times. Like James Cameron, she's a National Geographic explorer in residence. She's former chief scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a legend in ocean research. Sylvia Earle, it's a pleasure to have you with us again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be on board, Tom.
Also joining us from the other side of the country, Durham, North Carolina, is Dr. Craig McLean. He is a deep-sea biologist specializing in biodiversity and ecology, runs the science blog Deep Sea News. He's also the assistant director of science at the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center, knows the life of the deep. Craig McLean, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Sylvia Earle, try and picture out there on that ship right now. Here they are, a couple hundred miles, I guess, south of Guam, above the Mariana Trench. He's going to be going straight down. We asked the National Geographic Society what they're waiting for, and they said they really need calm seas, no wind. They're going to take this thing, and on a crane, the submersible goes off the deck to be lowered into the water. Dangerous moment. A lot can go wrong. What do you envision on that ship right now as they wait for those conditions, Sylvia?
I think they're being appropriately cautious to get it right. They've already made a descent 5 miles down, and that's deeper than any existing submersible with a human being tucked inside can actually do. So they've already broken a record, but the ultimate one is out there about ready to happen. And a lot of us are cheering Jim Cameron on with high hopes, or deep hopes, I guess.
Right. Very deep. Almost 7 miles. Craig McLean, what can you tell us about this submersible that he's going down in? It's very long, and it goes straight down, sort of, I don't know if you call it nose or butt down first, but it's vertical as it goes down.
That's right. It has a very unique profile to it. Unlike most submersibles that sort of go, as you mentioned, in sort of a flatter plane as they descend, this one will be going sort of nose first. And from what I can see, it looks like it's going to be going down at a much faster rate than most submersibles, about 150 feet per minute.
Why does that make sense? Does it matter if you go fast or slow? He's going to spend maybe 6 hours way down there, we're told, if everything goes to plan. Why go down fast? Do you save on oxygen? Is there some practical reason for that?
The specs for the submersibles are that he'll have about 54 hours, way more than he needs, of oxygen.
Okay.
And but keep in mind that, you know, these long descents, that we're talking, you know, a submersible is limited by the human inside of it. And he's going to be in this tight, cramped sphere for, you know, six hours plus. And mm-hmm. so limiting that descent to the bottom, that descent time is pretty important.
So, Sylvia Earle, why has it been so long since anybody's been down there, more than half a century?
Oh, it's the great mystery of the sea. We really need to explore the ocean. And while Cameron's vehicle is destined or designed to be able to go fast to the bottom and then spend maximum bottom time on the bottom, I hope this will lead to and inspire systems that will be able to carry more than one person and to be equipped with the kind of capacity to go anywhere in the water column. After all, it isn't just the surface and just the bottom that count. The ocean itself, that juicy bit in the middle,
mm-hmm.
is what needs exploration as well as the configuration of the seafloor below. And it's there to be done. We have the technology. What we've been lacking is the will. It's so frustrating that with this exciting new expedition, at the same very same time, our government, NOAA, is about to zero out the National Underwater Research Program that has to do with the technology that will give us access to the sea. It was the year of the ocean, 1998, when we lost the last capacity to go to 6,000 meters when the sea cliff was retired. We've fallen behind. Other nations, notably China, has a 7,000-meter sub they're testing this summer. India is building one. Russia has three that go to 6,000 meters. France has one. And here we are, allegedly the technological leader of the world. And as far as the ocean is concerned, it takes inspired individuals such as Jim Cameron to take the lead. And actually, that little sub was built in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Craig, Sylvia Earle attests to the importance of going down there, but explain that importance to us. I mean, humans have gotten along all right for millennia, much more, without being 7,000 feet, 7 miles under the sea nearly. What might we learn down there, Craig? And what's the payoff of learning that could await us?
Well, I mean, I think one of the reasons why we do this is the same reason why our country put a man on the moon. I mean, our country is one of the great things about our country is this history of exploration. And so this is another step in that. We should explore it because it's there. And as far as the life that's there, I mean, we know very little about what's at the bottom in terms of the life that is there. There's only been a handful, as Sylvia mentioned, only a handful of expeditions that have actually visited the deep. And most of those had only took a handful of samples from that. And so we know that there are microbes in the sediment. There are small single-celled organisms that live in there. There was the potential for a couple expeditions have found sea cucumbers, which are mm-hmm. relatives to starfish, and a handful of worms that we know from that area. But beyond that, we really don't know much about the ecology and natural history of the organisms there.
When we see the photographs, or perhaps it's illustrations of bizarre deep sea fish, I think, with sort of tentacles that look like they're dangling lanterns and all that, is that not this far down, Craig?
That's right. Those are, well, shallower than this. There's the deepest known fish is about 8,500 meters, so a little over around 6 miles or so.
Okay.
And this is, you know, much deeper than that. And so we don't really know. The original dive by Picard and Walsh, reported that they saw flatfish, but of course they were looking at a very small porthole. There was no video documentation. And so there has been some skepticism of that. Again, they many people have suggested that it wasn't a flatfish that they saw, but rather a sea cucumber swimming along the bottom. And so we don't know at this point. We have no evidence that there are fish there. But again, it, being so undersampled, we don't really know.
We share the planet, but we just don't know what's down there. Sylvia Earle, what's your hope for what of most value we may learn?
Well, here's the thing. That area that is below where the deepest diving submersibles other than Cameron's can presently go is an area the size of the United States or Australia or China. This is a huge part of the planet. Some say, oh, it's only 2% of the ocean or 3% of the ocean, however you count. Whatever it is, it's big. And we don't have access there. And it's a unique environment, 16,000 pounds of pressure per square inch. And it's cold and it's dark, and yet life prospers there. Wherever there's water on this planet, there is likely to be life, even in the deep cracks beneath the bottom of the ocean. How can we not want to know and put it on the balance sheet? We don't climb Mount Everest 97% of the way up and then stop. We want to go and understand everything we can about the nature of Earth. And so we're missing a big piece of it by not having access.
There's a lot that we do not know about the bottom, the very bottom, the deep Mariana Trench, the Challenger Deep of the Deep Blue Sea. It was 1960 the last time anybody went down there, and here's a little bit of that. The sound transmissions, in this case, this was Jacques Picard and with his American comrade Walsh talking on the way down as the little ship, the Trieste, descended into the depths of the Marianas Trench. Here he's talking with the communications team on the USS Wandock on the surface.
Hello, yes, this is the Trieste. This is the Trieste. I heard you very well.
Go ahead, Trieste, over. This is Winding. We have bioluminescence at 32.
Trieste, again, over.
1960, and that's the last time people went down. In 1960, the American Don Walsh and the Frenchman Jacques Picard, they went down that deep. And last week, they sat down with the Pacific News Center in Guam to share some of their predictions, what they had thought at the time about when the next dive would be.
After we surfaced in the deep dive 52 years ago, we were waiting to be picked up with our rubber boat and taken back to our mothership. And we're thinking, well, about how long will it be before the next people come back here and continue exploring the deep trench? And I think we kind of came out agreeing that 2 years would be about right. 2 years. And now it's been 52 years.
They thought it would be 2 years. It's 52. That's a long time, especially these days when there's so much capacity or could be around. Here's James Cameron, the director, talking with National Geographic earlier this month, explaining how little we know about life in the deepest extremes of the ocean, known as the Hadal Zone.
The Hadal depths are very poorly understood by science. They're really the last frontier of exploration here on planet Earth. We know very little about the species that live down there. We know very little about the distribution of the biological communities. We don't know how these animals have adapted to living under this unbelievable pressure that exists down there, 7 miles down at the bottom of the ocean.
But we may learn. Sylvia Earle and Craig McLean are with us. And Sylvia, Craig, I understand that this expedition is sending down in advance of Cameron's vessel. They're sending down what they call unmanned landers to the trench bottom, 13 feet tall, camera-equipped submersibles that will carry bait, fishing one more time, to lure sea creatures into plastic cylinders that then, I guess, with his robot arms, Sylvia, he'll be able to harvest those to bring back to the surface?
That is the hope. In fact, Deep Ocean Exploration and Research here, DOER Marine in Oakland, has contributed something to that with the arm and sampling equipment. So I have a really great interest in seeing how successful they are.
What can you tell us about the terrain of the ocean floor at that great depth? Does it look similar to what we see elsewhere at significant depths? Are there unique features about it at that depth? I suppose it's got lots of characteristics if it's the size of the United States, but still, what do you imagine that ocean floor looks like?
Well, we just are so eager to actually find out. There is sediment that has accumulated over over the millennia that has drifted down to the bottom. When the Trieste touched bottom years ago, they stirred up a cloud of sediment. But it depends on where within the trench they actually land, whether it's rocky or whether it's flat, just as on the surface. There's a lot of configuration. There's just so much about the ocean. There are whole mountain chains that we have barely begun to explore. This is, I hope, the beginning of the greatest era of exploration yet. We just don't know our blue backyard.
Does it matter that it's that deep? I mean, that's
yes.
closer to the center of the Earth than any place else on the Earth. We hear about volcanic activity, about volcanic vents.
It's a unique environment, a unique pressure environment, and it has been little disturbed by us. It's also, these are areas where the subduction zones, where in the trenches, where the ocean floor gets crunched under the crust of the ocean, mm-hmm. and so very special interest. It's one of the reasons that Japan has invested quite a lot in deep sea exploration and monitoring with their Shinkai 6500 to go actually physically explore with geologists to observe what's there. Sending remote systems is really helpful. Its whole oceanographic institution has actually descended into the trench with their remotely operated system. But there is a qualitative difference in having a human presence with all of the experience and all the capability that the human mind and brain can bring to the situation, just as there is for having astronauts up in the sky. We need both. We need remote systems, and we need the human presence.
Craig McLean, what about temperature at this depth? Is it cold because it's so deep or warm because it's closer to the hot center of the Earth?
It'll still be cold. It'll be probably right around freezing or so.
Around freezing?
So, mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. And how do you picture it? I mean, they're sending down these landers filled with bait. Do you picture little critters sort of crawling along the bottom and say, woohoo, here's dinner, let's go?
Absolutely. The deep sea is because of the lack of light, there's no plants. And for most of the deep sea, the organisms are relying upon the amount of food or food sinking down from the ocean surface. And that amount that actually falls from the ocean surface, that's material that we call marine snow, is both poor quality and there's very little of it that makes it down there. In fact, if you took the whole surface of the ocean and the amount of primary production that you see there, and we equate that with a 5-pound bag of sugar, then the amount that would make it down to the deep sea floor would be about 3 tablespoons.
Wow. So whatever life means, there must subsist on very little nutrition.
That's right. And so when you put down a baited trap, this is basically a smorgasbord for these animals. And most deep sea animals can detect chemical cues of these sort of large food falls from a great distance, and they'll swarm into these baited traps.
So they should.
And that includes both things like fish and crustaceans.
Wow. So whatever's there is probably going to be pretty excited about this feast coming down. Let's go to our listeners. Rutherfordton, North Carolina. Steve's calling. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is twofold. Number one, I realize we keep finding things in the oceans that we thought were extinct. There is a lot of water out there. What if we found a trilobite? And keeping that in mind that there is so much water and undiscovered areas in the ocean, if we found a trilobite, and I personally think there just happens to be one out there, what would that do to the theory of evolution?
Wow, great question. Craig, I'll bring that first to you. A trilobite, what I guess Earth's earliest sort of life form, a chance that you could find something from way back in the evolutionary train down there? And what about the range of what we could discover in terms of interest and evolution's understanding?
Sure. So there has been there's been a longstanding idea about the deep sea being a refuge for these sort of fossil organisms. And probably the classic example is the coelacanth. And, so is there a trilobite on the deep sea floor? You know, because so little of it's explored, it's hard to say about that. I hope that if there is, that I'm the one who discovers it.
You better hurry.
I'm working on it. You know, if we find a trilobite, I don't think that it says – I don't think it sort of says anything about evolution. I mean, we – there are lots of organisms that have been around since, you know, the Cambrian explosion millions and millions and millions of years ago that are still around today. You know, things like starfish and but they've changed a lot since that time. And I can imagine that if we found a trilobite today, it would have characteristics that were very similar to that seen, you know, when trilobites still wandered the Earth. But there would be differences. And so and including, you know, adaptations, you know, presuming this is a deep sea trilobite, adaptations to live in the deep sea.
What other features of life? I mean, maybe some evolutionary insight there, though the adaptation even there would have taken place, as you say, though, gosh, it's almost kind of time travel to imagine coming across a trilobite. But when we hear about life that doesn't require sun, life that, as you say, that needs little nutrition, life that can exist at those temperatures and pressures and, I don't know, even toxicity down there with very little oxygen, what does that tell us about the profile of the life that would be there?
Well, I mean, the deep sea environment is an environment of extremes, and you mentioned some. We've talked about some of those. We've talked about extreme cold, the extreme pressure that's seen there, and those present, you know, sort of unique challenges to deep sea organisms. So, in terms of pressure, at great pressures, one of the things that happens is that the three-dimensional structure of proteins and enzymes actually starts to break down. And so to equip with that, what you see is that deep-sea organisms have increased hydrogen bonding that keeps the rigidity of the proteins and allows them to function like they normally would. You can imagine that if we break down the protein structure, that it will cease to function as a protein.
If we could find that life and examine it, does it have implications for application up at sea level, way above the native habitat?
Absolutely. I mean, when you study life at the extremes, you begin to uncover and unravel how biological processes work. So if you want to understand how organisms are dependent on food, understanding how organisms survive on little food is probably the best avenue to go to understand how that works.
Sylvia?
Yeah, you know, it's like the first access to this great part of the planet. The microbes count, of course, and how are they making a living? Chemosynthesis as another approach to deriving food is prevalent in deep-sea dark environments, and there are so many mysteries there to be unraveled. There are so-called living fossils, and Craig mentioned the starfish, but whole categories of life, the jellyfish, the horseshoe crabs that were contemporaries of trilobites. Several species are currently plying the waters of the world, not in the deep sea, but in our shallow Atlantic coastal areas and several in the Pacific, Asian Pacific as well. This is such an important breakthrough. If we came back with even a tiny fraction of something alive from Mars or any place else on the planet, we would be so excited. And right here in our own backyard, if you will, we've only seen about 5% of the ocean. Most of it is yet to be explored. And why has it taken us so long? And why aren't there big headlines just shouting out the new discoveries that are important in this part of the universe, this little blue speck in the universe that keeps us alive?
James Cameron slated to be down there, and soon here he is talking again to the Pacific News Network about some of the many working parts he'll have to maneuver during a intended six-hour or so dive.
The pilot is very busy in this vehicle. I've got seven joysticks, and I've got to take one hand off one to work another one in order to operate the lights. There are lights that are on pan and tilt, spotlights that move, cameras that move, manipulators that move, thrusters that have to be continuously operated. I asked them for some software to control the thrusters so it would help keep me in place while I'm moving some of the other things. But, you know, you're pretty busy.
Pretty busy down there. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. Stuart's calling. Hi, Stuart. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Appreciate the show. I was if you brought a creature up from that depth, and since it's adapted to survive at that depth, what's that going to do to it when it gets to the surface?
Yeah, good question. Craig, any way it would live if it's accustomed to living at 16,000 pounds per square inch of pressure?
There are some organisms that we can actually bring back from the deep sea. For example, personally, you know, brought sea urchins, starfish, snails from, over a few miles deep. And so
they don't explode at surface pressures?
No, there are, they do not. Once the organism's adapted to high pressures, it seems to be that it can be well equipped for low pressures as well.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, there are some things, softer, sort of mushier sea cucumbers don't seem to make the trip very well. The real big difference seems to be the temperature differences. And so if you bring back an organism from the very deep, very cold sea floor back into bring it up through the water column, mm-hmm. Through warm water, that usually will kill off the organism. And so a lot of the way that we sample the deep sea organisms when we keep them alive is by putting them into thermal boxes.
So bring them up in a cooler.
Mm-hmm. That being said, colleagues of mine at the University of Hawaii actually have worked a lot on bringing back deep sea fish alive to the surface, which are one of the ones that we cannot bring back to the surface alive without special precautions. And they have a huge sort of pressure chamber that they capture. It's like a baited trap that's a big pressure vessel, and they capture a fish inside of it, and they're able to bring this whole pressure vessel back to the ocean surface.
So it sounds like there's a decent chance with a number of species that they would make it to the top. Tommy in Bucksport, Tennessee. Tommy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering, with 5 decades in advancements in cameras, I was wondering if the type of cameras being taken down are going to be for shooting a movie or if this is purely research.
Huh. Great question. Sylvia?
Yes. They'll be the best cameras that can be adapted for this purpose, and one hopes that they'll be able to be communicated to a wide audience through public film, but certainly the better the images, the better the science. You want the best resolution possible. And you can be sure that Jim Cameron is doing everything that he can to make certain that the images are of the highest quality that we can currently muster. It's amazing. Here's a private enterprise, private initiative, National Geographic, Rolex, Jim Cameron himself, mounting something that could really launch an exciting new era of exploration that I hope will sweep the world.
It is amazing. I mean, Craig, he's going to bring up or plans to bring up, rock samples, the surface samples from the ocean floor surface. What about images themselves? Can you interpret them as we've seen space interpretation has been done to discern the makeup of that ocean floor, Craig?
Absolutely. The organisms that are visual to the eye, that don't, not the microscopic organisms, obviously, but there's a lot of really great deep sea research now that counts on high image digital video, and we analyze that video frame by frame, counting the organisms there, and we can sometimes get identifications even down to the species level for those.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the bottom of the deepest ocean floor, 6.8 miles down in the Pacific, deeper than Mount Everest is high, where director, explorer James Cameron is right now poised to dive. Mariana Trench, the Challenger Deep. Sylvia Earle, the great oceanographer, is with us. Craig McLean, great deep sea biologist with us from Durham, North Carolina. Sylvia is in California today. The ship is out there on the water. They're waiting for the right calm conditions for the crane arm to take this over the side of the ship, the Mermaid Sapphire, get it pointed down to that depth, and down it will go. Here's James Cameron earlier this month telling CNN about how powerfully he's drawn to the sea.
I love my family, my kids. There's nothing I love more. But I also have to do this. I also have to go look. It's like Jimmy Stewart says in How the West Was Won. Sometimes you just got to go see the critter.
Just go see the critter. We've got feedback online here. Christopher writes, do animated sea creatures and mermaids really sing show tunes down there? Well, we'll find out, Christopher. But here's Robert saying on Facebook, you know, this sounds cheaper, safer, and potentially more profitable than going to Mars. And as Sylvia Earle says, much closer to home. Let's go to Holly in Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Holly, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I'm wondering, biologists seem to really be on the forefront of exploring the deep sea, but are there companies, and I'm not a proponent of this, but are there companies that are out there with big money looking to prospect down there and go for the natural resources and the minerals and the mining rights and, you know, the potential beyond the amazing biologic potential?
Let us pick it up. Sylvia Earle, what do you say?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are vested interests that are looking, especially for mining, and mining samples of life that might be replicated under certain circumstances. Pharmaceutical companies do and should have an interest in, just as we do in looking at rainforests as the recipes that we can then adapt for our human applications. But most importantly, we need to look at the ocean, to understand the ocean, and realize that the ocean keeps us alive. It's easy to use the ocean as a garbage dump, really easy to think of the ocean as a place to take things, whether it's oil, gas, fish, or minerals, or whatever. But the real trick and the real importance of what Jim Cameron is doing now is to open our eyes, open our minds to how important the ocean is as our life support system. The ocean drives climate and weather. It's home for most of life on Earth, and most of life on Earth lives in the dark. It's below the skin of the ocean, below that sunlit portion. Mm-hmm. The average depth of the ocean is 2.5 miles, and we're just beginning to understand that the ocean keeps us alive. And while there are fortunes to be extracted from the sea, whether it's treasure or mining the biological resources or the minerals, our biggest challenge right now is not disturbing, but rather protecting the ocean. Only about a fraction of 1% of the ocean enjoys the kind of protection that we give to national parks and other special places on the land.
Sylvie, let me ask you, I know that you are a huge defender of the ocean environment, and we've spoken and heard you speak very passionately about that, but I'm not sure of the origin of Holly's question, but so you want to defend it. You don't want to disturb everything, but you know if there are valuable minerals and so on down there, in addition to mining life, in a sense, possibly for insights, people may go after it. I mean, deep ocean oil drilling, it's getting deeper and deeper. Do we know about the mineral or geological profile of this depth and what might be down there that might indeed suddenly, you know, we'd find all kinds of commercial equipment on the surface reaching down for, Sylvia?
Well, we're doing it in ignorance now. Before the Deepwater Horizon well was struck in the Gulf of Mexico, we really didn't know what was there. We hadn't really done an extensive kind of evaluation. What Cameron's capacity to explore the ocean will do is give us the technology that we really need to understand, first of all, what's there. And as we do move into the sea, our exclusive economic zones out 200 miles, there's another whole United States that's underwater, if you will. Australia, there's a blue Australia. And then there's the heart of the ocean, the high seas. That's 64% of the ocean that is basically up for grabs without the kind of jurisdiction that individual nations can apply to their exclusive economic zone. So this is really an era of not only opportunity, but responsibility. First responsibility is to know what's there and put it on the balance sheet for more than just pounds of meat in terms of fish or pounds of minerals in terms of mining or oil and gas. There are other assets, other values that we really need to understand first.
Fair enough, and very clear. Liz in North Andover, Massachusetts. Liz, thanks for calling. You're on.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This actually segues really nicely into what he just said about responsibility. My question is, what is being done to ensure that when we go down there, we don't contaminate what's down there with something that's never been introduced to that environment, almost like an invasive species, if you will.
Yep.
And vice versa, how do we make sure, maybe this is coming from my fear of that movie, The Andromeda Strain, but how do we make sure we don't bring anything up that's potentially dangerous?
Craig McLean, the kudzu question, the invasive species or you know, some kind of cross-infection here. What about that risk?
Sure. So, I mean, I think the first thing to keep in mind is that the deep oceans are not decoupled from the shallow oceans. It's a continuous loop. So, you know, the kinds of things that may infect or vice versa have already been introduced to one another way before we began exploring the oceans.
Because columns of ocean movement and gravity move things down. Do they also move things up, though? Does what's down there
That's
really
right.
come
there
up?
That's right. There are spots where there is upwelling regions where we have currents that move the water column up to the surface and bring that cold, rich, nutrient-rich water up to the sea surface.
So you don't see a real risk there?
No, I don't. And keep in mind that, you know, the organisms that are in the deep are sort of uniquely adapted to that the environmental extremes there, much like shallow water organisms are adapted to those. Now, that being said, there are protocols that scientists have used when they visit different hydrothermal vents in which, you know, which requires scrubbing of the submersible or the remotely operated vehicle they're using and disinfecting it before they visit a new site so they're not potentially transplanting diseases and things along that line.
So maybe not an Andromeda strain scenario one way or the other, Liz. We hope anyway. Martin, one more call. Charleston, South Carolina. Martin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And hello to Craig and Sylvia. Craig, I want to thank you for many years ago taking me on a research expedition when I was a student at Scripps. I spent about two decades as a marine seafloor geophysicist, and I really want to applaud what James Cameron is doing by trying to, in his Titanic movie, he showed us so much of some of the technology and seafloor workings, and in this expedition of trying to really take us forward, and I think it's a wonderful thing. Earlier, Craig answered a question about why we do this, and his answer was basically one of the great answers to all scientific questions, which is because it's there. And I also wanted to just emphasize the fact that there are practical uses to things that we don't know what we don't know about yet.
Mm-hmm.
So if we think about things like the animals in the rainforest and the types of medications that we're finding from there, that we never had the idea that we could be there until people started exploring in the rainforest. The same type of thing is essential in the oceans. And as Sylvia said, it's better to work from points of understanding than from ignorance. We need to have a sense of, in terms of the previous caller's question, how do we know what we might be doing bad? We don't know unless we understand what types of things are there that we can affect.
So in a way, you've got to go to know, or at least get your landers down there. Martin, I appreciate your call. As someone who's been down there, it sounds like down there with Craig McLean, it's good to hear from you. Our time is short in this segment. We're going to talk in a moment about the new search for Amelia Earhart. You know, we've got a question here, Sylvia Earle from Marusa. She says, why was James Cameron chosen to go down there instead of a scientist? What do you think? I mean, he's been down a lot. We know he's got a love of the sea and he's done a lot with it. But why James Cameron, Sylvia?
Well, why not? James Cameron is well-schooled in science and engineering. He is an amazing individual. We know him perhaps best for his talents in the arts with the great blockbuster films, but he really is one of those special human beings with many talents. I would trust his observations and his keen way of an honest way of reporting, which is what scientists do, observe carefully, report honestly, and document what you see. And he did, by the way, take the initiative and make it happen. It's his right to be the one, to be the first down there, but I think this just opens the way for others, both scientists, philosophers, artists, whoever.
Let's hope they all follow his footsteps or bubbles on the way down, but in some ways, you really have to applaud him for taking the initiative, getting the thing built, and arranging to head down. We wish him good luck on that trip. Sylvia Earle, it is always wonderful to have you with us. We thank you so much for being with us today as James Cameron sits on the deck of that ship waiting to go down. Thank you so much for joining
us. Real explorer.
Craig McLean, are you jealous of Mr. Cameron there?
Absolutely.
Well, maybe much of the world will be jealous. We hope it goes safely, and we hope it goes swiftly and brings us back a lot of insight. Craig McLean, he runs the science blog Deep Sea News and joins us today from Durham, North Carolina. Dr. McLean, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, we'll hear about the newest effort to find the lost trail of Amelia Earhart. This is On Point. This year marks 75 years since Amelia Earhart embarked on her famous 1937 round-the-world flight and disappeared. Between Papua New Guinea and Howland Island, she and her plane wreckage were never found. A new expedition in the Pacific will attempt to do just that. After several unsuccessful land searches, this expedition will dive into the sea and use robotics to scour the floor in search of Earhart's plane. Joining me now from Wilmington, Delaware, is Rick Gillespie, founder and director of TIGER, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, a nonprofit dedicated to aviation archaeology and historic preservation. The group is mounting the expedition. Rick Gillespie, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Tom.
So where are you headed, and what equipment are you headed with? What's your game plan?
Well, where we're headed is back to Nikumaroro, the island that was formerly known as Gardner Island, the place where all the available evidence points to Amelia Earhart having landed and sent radio distress calls for several days before her plane was washed over the reef edge, and then she and her navigator marooned on a desert island, eventually died there. Our previous land searches, I would say, were very successful. They've led us to this evidence that points us to where we should search for the airplane.
How do we know that she and her navigator were marooned on a desert island and died there? Is that speculation
that,
or that's
that what we have is a preponderance of circumstantial evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from a variety of different threads of investigation. It's compelling, but it's circumstantial. And what we need is what everybody refers to as a smoking gun, and that would be the wreckage of the airplane. So that's what we're going after.
Now, there's a new photograph it's not new, it's old, but it's making the rounds right now. I guess taken from perhaps this area a few months after the plane went down, old black and white photo, and it shows in one corner, I don't know, just a little something sticking out of the water, a little dark speck sticking out of the water. Listeners can see it at our website, onpointradio.org. Is that part of the trail you're following, Rick?
Absolutely. Fascinating photograph. As you say, it was taken 3 months after Earhart disappeared. There was a British expedition to this uninhabited island. They were there to check it out for possible future settlement. They weren't looking for Amelia.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the cadet officers, British Colonial Service, who were there, took a whole bunch of pictures. And this was one of them. It's just a snapshot of the west end of the island. It shows an old shipwreck that's there. And we had had this photograph for years, but the copy of the photograph that I had been referencing, I'm the culprit here. I had cropped that photo back in 1990 when we first got it,
mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until 2010 when we were getting ready for our expedition that year that our forensic imaging specialist suggested that we look at all our old negatives of historical photos and see if there's anything of interest there that we ought to check out when we're back on the island. And he called me and he said, well, what's the thing sticking up out of the water on the left-hand side of the frame of that photo that Bevington took? And I said, there's nothing sticking up out of the water. He says, yes, there is. No, there isn't. And he sent me what he was looking at. And it's a no-brainer. I mean, there is this thing sticking up out of the water.
Well, you say no-brainer, but when I look at it, there's this fuzzy little dark spot there, and it reminds me for all the world of all the photos we've seen of the Loch Ness Monster, which we've never put our finger on.
As a matter of fact, that's what we called it. We called
Nessie.
It Nessie for a long time. It's just something sticking out of the water.
You think it might be part of the fuselage or a wing or something?
No, what we think it might be is landing gear. Now, our forensic imaging guide did the enhancement work that is available now, all the algorithms and so forth. It's quite a science. And he expressed his opinion that all the components of an Electra landing gear are there, the shapes and sizes and dimensions. And we wanted to be sure about this, as sure as we could be, so we asked the State Department if some government photo analysts could take a fresh look at this thing, disinterested replication of results, peer review, the essence of the scientific method. And we gave them the photograph, they looked at it, called me in for a briefing and said, we see pretty much the same thing your guy sees. And
wow.
This turns out to be in the same spot where in 1999, an old lady in Fiji who had grown up on that island, the daughter of the island carpenter, had her father had pointed out to her wreckage on the reef in about 1940 that he told her was part of an airplane. And we asked her to mark the map for us. Now, this is back in 1999, before this photo thing came up. And son of a gun, you know, where she said her father pointed out wreckage is the same spot where we now have multiple forensic imaging people telling us, no, it's consistent with the landing gear of a Lockheed Electra.
How long are you going to spend looking, Rick?
We plan to have 10 days on site.
What do you think of your odds of finding something here? We'll know soon enough, so be conservative.
Well, if we're out there and there's something obvious, obviously that'll be immediate. If whatever is there requires more analysis or even recovery before we can analyze it, it'll take longer. You know, you can never predict results. You just do your best on the best available evidence.
Well, 75 years and still keen interest in Amelia Earhart and whatever happened with her. We wish you luck with the expedition. Rick Gillespie.
Thank you.
Rick Gillespie, director of the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. They're headed to the Pacific on the trail of Amelia Earhart in June. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.